Hello, people of the world, and welcome to today's episode of the Unity Project podcast. If you are just tuning in for the first time, the Unity Project is a podcast about the relationships that we have with our bodies. I'm super excited to introduce to you today's guest. Her name is Amber Cantorna. Amber is an author, speaker, and storyteller. She wrote the book called Refocusing My Family and Unashamed. Amber is passionate about supporting LGBTQ people through their coming out process and educating others on the critical importance of full inclusion. She believes that that is one of the most powerful acts of reformation we can give to the human race. I learned so much from this interview with Amber and was so honored to get a chance to listen to her story and just get to ask her questions about what it was like for her growing up in the evangelical church world that she did. Before our interview, I had a chance to check out her book, Refocusing My Family, and learned a ton from that as well. So much. And I could not recommend that book or really just listening to what she has to say enough. I get so excited when people are passionate about talking to the LGBTQ community and creating a space and reminding those in that community that they're not alone and that they're beautiful and loved and perfect and all the really good things. So I hope you enjoyed this interview and I will see you soon. If you guys are enjoying listening to the Unity Project podcast and you want to support me as a podcaster, a writer, any of the things, if you want to become a part of the Unity Project podcast, then go to patreon.com/JackieGTV. That is where you can support me for as little as $1 a month. That will help me make this podcast everything that I dream for it to be and write the books that I dream to write. And all the things, you guys. If you want to support me, go ahead and do that. Or if you want to read my story and find out how I got from there to here and any and all the things, you can read my book, Finding Home. You can pick up a copy of that at my website, www.jackiegronlund.com. Or if you want to support me but you cannot afford to financially, then leaving a review for this podcast is incredibly helpful. Anywhere that you listen to podcasts, just go down there. You don't have to say much. Just however you feel about it, let me know. That helps a lot more than I think a lot of people realize. So yeah, enjoy. Amber, how is it going over there? How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing well, thanks.
Awesome. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast today. You're in Colorado, you said?
I am. I'm in Denver.
Oh, Denver. That's so cool. I grew up in Colorado. I grew up in Aurora.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Just a little south of me. We're out by the airport. So.
Oh, you're by the airport.
We're real close to the Denver-Aurora border.
Okay, very cool. Then I lived like 20 minutes from you. We might have passed each other in the grocery store at some point.
Well, I didn't grow up in Denver, but I've been here for about 8 years.
Okay, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Colorado Springs.
Okay, cool.
So, a little south.
I got you. I went to school there for one semester, and then I decided, never mind, I'm
moving
away.
That was enough.
Yeah, that was enough for me. Oh my gosh. Well, Amber, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast today. For those listening, I came across Amber through my friend Matthias's podcast, Queerology, who I think I've mentioned, two podcasts ago. I interviewed someone else that I found through him. So thank you to Matthias for finding all the good people.
He's a good one.
Yes, he's so good. His podcast was the first one I was ever on, so it's so fun to be able to kind of just intermix worlds.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Amber, I am stoked to have you on the podcast today. To start off, I want to ask you the question that I ask everyone at the beginning, is to describe the relationship that you have with your body and to then talk about a time when you felt the most disconnected from your body.
Oh, gosh, I would say that my relationship with my body has been complicated.
Uh-huh.
I grew up in the ultra-conservative world of homeschooling and evangelical Christianity and focus on the family in Colorado Springs. So from a very young age, I was taught that our bodies are bad and not to be trusted.
Mm.
And so I think that really shaped how I viewed myself and how I interacted in the world. Things like purity culture were a big part of my upbringing. Really taught to trust those in authority over you and not listen to your own inner voice. And so as I began to struggle with things that I wouldn't identify for years down the road, like the fact that I was gay, struggling with those early on caused a lot of division inside of me and a lot of self-hatred about who I was, because I was taught that who I was not okay and was not acceptable in the eyes of God or in the eyes of my family and those that I loved.
Oh my gosh.
So I would say it was very complicated from a very early age.
Yeah, it sounds like it. That sounds so lonely. For those listening, Amber wrote a book called Refocusing My Family. That's what it's called, right?
Yes.
Okay, Refocusing My Family, which I think is such an incredible name, because I read a good chunk of it, and from what I was reading, it sounded like growing up, you were very invested and involved in kind of what, like, I guess the outward messages of Focus on the Family were about, like, bringing your family together and, like, what values and what not to have in that. And so I didn't finish your book, but I just think it's really special how you kind of went back to that and were like, this is how I actually want to do that, and kind of reclaiming that.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool. What was that like growing up in that? I know at the beginning of the book, you were talking about having such a good relationship with your parents at a young age and being so involved in, like, Adventures in Odyssey and all that stuff. What was that like?
Well, I really didn't know anything different. You know, mm-hmm. That was my world. That was all that I knew. I had no exposure to what my parents would have called, like, the outside world, right? Like, they had me very cocooned in this ultra-conservative Christian bubble. And I think intentionally did that to try and, quote-unquote, keep me safe and protected. And so I really knew nothing else. And in many ways, I was happy. We had a strong family unit. We had a lot of traditions that were steeped around the holidays. We had, you know, strong ties to our church and faith community. And I remember my mom often telling me, you know, like, Amber, friends will come and go, but your family will always be there for you.
Mm.
And she would often tell me, like, how good we had it. You know, like, not everybody has a family like this, and you should be very grateful that you have what you have. And so I remember those kind of values being taught to me with nothing really else to compare it to, because my world was very small, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. My parents used to say a lot of the same things. Like, my dad made this big deal growing up about how, like, everyone will leave you but your family, so put your family first always, or you'll have, like, mm-hmm. no one at your funeral, stuff mm-hmm. like that. I'm like, what? Fear tactics for sure. But it just, that feels so relatable to me, that it, like, puts that above everything. So it almost just tunes out any other, it does just kind of tune out any other message. Because for me, it made me believe, like, oh, my family's right. So that means that tied into, like, religion and church stuff. That means, like, okay, what my dad says goes, and that's just how it is, and everything else is wrong.
Yeah.
Did you have a similar experience as that, or what was that like?
Yeah, we were kind of taught to just, you know, like, whatever your parents says is the gospel truth. Whatever anybody in authority over you says in terms of, you know, church leaders or whatnot, they were the voice of God and could not be questioned or could not be wrong. So even wondering, even questioning, even doubting was seen in a very negative light.
Ah, okay. That makes a lot of sense. What was communicated to you growing up as, like, what it meant to be a girl or a woman? Like, what was expected of you? I was reading, you talked a lot about, I think it's Proverbs 31. Is that the verse? Like, the Proverbs 31 woman,
yes,
or something?
Yes.
Yeah. Like, what, do you want to talk about that a little bit, and, like, what was expected of you?
Well, I think what was expected of me was to be a good Christian woman, which by definition is usually submissive, right, to their mm-hmm. to their authority, to their husband. I think it was expected of me that I would grow up and marry possibly a pastor or a minister, and have a family and raise children. In fact, my parents didn't really even advocate much for higher education for me. I literally remember my mom telling me, like, what's the point of going to school and accumulating all this debt if you're just going to get married and have babies?
Mm.
And so they never even really advocated for higher education or for really finding independence and confidence as a woman. It was just expected that you were secondary to the man and that you would submit to them. And so those messages of keeping a good house, of raising kids, of cooking and cleaning, those were things that my mom did very well, but that were kind of automatically expected of me as well and of who I would become in the future.
Yeah.
I think my options were a lot more limited than those for my brother.
How did you experience your brother growing up? Like, did you notice the differences and whatnot then, or did you not see them till more recently?
No, I did see them more, I think, you know, not so much when we were little kids, because, you know, elementary and age and around that time frame, we were fairly close. But I would say more in our teen years, I started seeing a difference. I'm older than him by about 3.5 years. And I still, you know, saw a difference in the way that they treated him and the amount of independence they gave him and the amount of respect for his opinion versus always questioning mine and not really giving me a voice of my own and respecting that the autonomy and that agency of who I was as a person.
Mm, okay. That makes a lot of sense. I've heard a lot recently and just kind of, I guess, reflecting on my childhood and whatnot and talking to others, so much about what the mother-daughter relationship, how much of an impact that has on the daughter's relationship with herself and her view of herself and just everything about what it means to be a woman. Because we look to our moms, at least from my experience and those I've talked to, like, we look to our moms to tell us what it means to be a woman and what value we have. And so, like, my mom, I would watch her just, like, tear apart her body and always be on diets and always be on, like, this. So that communicated to me, like, to be a woman, it means you have to be thin and be, it's all about image and whatnot. And from your messages, it, like, I know you talked in your book about how your mom always talked about how you had to be a blessing to people.
Right.
What do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I feel like that was kind of our main goal in life, was to always, quote unquote, be a blessing to others. So wherever we went, it never felt like I could just let down my hair and be myself. We always had to go with this kind of goal in mind to bless other people and to be a good example. So, I mean, I think underlying that was, like, you know, be on your best behavior, be good while we're there. Like, if we're traveling to see family, be good, help out, do chores, do things that are helpful. But also just be a good example. And I think that was expected of us most of the time. So I didn't feel like I could really just be wherever I was, if I was struggling or sad or having a hard time. I always kind of had to wear this facade of having it all together and being happy. Mm. And, you know, and there was things that my mom did very well when it comes to, you know, keeping a home and making it feel warm and inviting and making the holidays special and meaningful and traditions. And those are things that I really value from my relationship with her that I have in many ways carried on. But like you, she also, I don't think she had a good relationship with herself and her body. And again, was always on diets and would never leave the house without makeup. And so that too taught me a lot about who I was supposed to be and how I was supposed to look and how to measure up to society standards rather than, and she never really talked about emotions very much. She was never good at showing emotion. And therefore I too learned to really stuff emotions from a very young age, which ended up having consequences down the road as well.
Yeah. That makes sense. It sounds a lot. I know that you weren't a pastor's daughter, right?
No, not technically, but it was basically the same thing as, you know, when your dad's been an executive at Focus on the Family for 30 years.
Yeah, I was about to say, everything that I'm hearing sounds like pastor's kids stuff.
Yes.
And so it must have been like the same experience. Like, you were such the example and the role model and the one that had to be perfect, it sounds like.
Yes. And on a broad scale, because the work that my father did, you know, was known worldwide. So it was on an even bigger scale than a typical, you know, pastor's kid.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. How did you cope with that? Like, I know from personal experience, like, putting on the happy, everything's okay face does not last.
Mm-hmm,
How did you manage that? Like, did you have anywhere where you could go to kind of, I guess, like you said, let your hair down and be more authentically just how you felt?
I always was looking for that. I rarely found it, but I was always looking for that. That's what I was always craving and wanting. I had a couple people that passed through my life at different points in my teen years that I really gravitated towards because of that, because I felt safe to be myself and to let my hair down. But those were rare, and they often didn't last very long. And so I often didn't have a safe place to really let my hair down, where I didn't feel like I was being watched and kind of held up to that limelight and that pedestal. And so I learned to compartmentalize a lot and to wear that happy face even when I was really struggling inside, and then really didn't have safe places to process a lot of the other things I was feeling.
Ah. Okay. How did you cope with that? Like, were there strategies that you found that were helpful to kind of release that tension in other ways? Or what did that look like?
For me, I think one of the most helpful things was journaling at that time. In my teen years, I really gravitated towards journaling because that was kind of my only outlet of, I really didn't feel safe talking to people either, because I felt like it was gonna mess up my image, it was gonna mess up my family name, or I couldn't trust them to keep the confidence. I really just had a hard time trusting people. And so journaling, and often, you know, talking to God, because I had a close relationship with God growing up that was, you know, fostered in our family, was something that I found great comfort in. And I mean, looking back, I've got piles of journals that, you know, when I went to write Refocusing My Family, I read through all of them. I pulled them all out. No, there was a lot. So I think that was really my survival tactic during those years, was just to journal everything, because it felt like kind of a safe space where I didn't have to worry about other people and what they would think or how they would react.
Oh, yeah. I love how in your book you have, like, photocopies of different parts of your journal in there to kind of, like, show where you're at. That felt so personal. So, like, I don't know. I mean, journaling, it is so incredible how it's kind of, like, similar to how you'd feel with a therapist that you, like, definitely trust. Because it's hard to find a therapist you really trust to really be able, which I'm sure you know, to let everything out. And so having like a journal where you know there's no one on the other side reading it, it's just this freedom to really learn about yourself. And that could get scary. I know that at the beginning you talked about how you hadn't journaled in, I think, like 4 years, was it?
Yeah. When I started the book, yeah. And I really haven't journaled much, even as in a lot of my adult years. It's kind of something I've strayed away from, that I haven't done as much of. But gosh, it was sure a lifeline for me then, you know?
Yes.
And because even therapy was really looked down upon and had a great stigma and taboo attached to it. And so if you were going to therapy, something was wrong with you, you know? And it wasn't something that you wanted to really embrace or share with people. Like, you know, I think we're kind of starting to break some of the stigma around mental health and therapy now. But in the religious world, that wasn't the case.
Yeah. Why do you think, I guess, like, looking back, why do you think there was a stigma around having any kind of mental health disorder or any kind of problems regarding mental health, like depression, anxiety, any of those things?
I think in the evangelical world, or in a lot of faith-based communities, mental health is seen as a fault, is seen as a something's wrong with you. You're not trusting God enough. You're not believing hard enough. You're not praying enough. You're not doing enough of the right things, because if you were, you wouldn't have this problem. Or if you were, it would fix you. And so it was seen as like, if you just have enough faith, you're not going to ever struggle with anything in life, right?
Yeah.
And and so it just creates this idea or this belief system that you have to always be okay. And people wore that facade really well. I just felt like I lived in this Barbie doll world where nobody really talked about what they were really feeling or going through. Nobody would ever let that barrier down. Everybody had to hold it together all the time and pretend like they were perfect. And so I just felt like I lived in this world full of masks and fake people. And I always hated that. That always bothered me. But I think it was also very suffocating.
Yeah. My gosh. It's almost like how you talked about at the beginning, how growing up in that world, you believed like your body was bad and whatnot. I feel like it feels so similar to just anything that fell outside of this box of, like you're saying, like, polished, perfect, happy, whatever image of like, I have a good relationship with God you can show is just seen as bad. So anytime you have like natural human emotions like anger or sadness or anxiety and depression, because that's so common, then it, like, to me growing up, that was communicated as like the enemy and that makes you bad. And
absolutely.
Oh my gosh. Like, just so many messages about that. And I know you had, in your book, I was reading about, I might be jumping ahead a bit, but an exorcism that you went through for, it's called trichotillomania?
Trichotillomania, yeah. Okay. So yeah, it was an exorcism. And that wasn't the first one I had experienced, you know.
Oh my gosh.
That was something that was fairly common at the church that I attended, and yet was terrifying to a young person who's just trying to figure things out and is struggling and is wanting support and love and help, and to feel like there's something so wrong with you that they have to cast demons out, you know, was quite traumatic, really. Mental health, I don't think, should ever be seen that way. Because it only compounds it, right? It only makes it worse if people tell you, well, there's something wrong with you and you're not able to fix it and you should just pray more. And so I think those kind of situations just caused me to become even more recluse and less trusting of people.
Yeah, that makes sense. Do you mind defining? I know my sister actually had trichotillomania growing up. So a lot of the things you were talking about, I've heard her talk about before. And do you mind telling the people listening what that is?
It's a hair pulling disorder that can be genetic. And in my family, I think, and in my case, I think it partially was. I did have a cousin that had it as well. And so it can be genetic, similar to obsessive compulsive disorder, but not quite the same. But it also can be brought on by stress and trauma. And in my case, I think that was a combination of both of those things. I think part of it was genetic, and I think part of it was the stress of having to hold things together from a very young age and not having a safe place to process them. Because I was molested as a kid, and I was, wrestling with a lot of emotions, but still having to put on this facade to kind of uphold the family name. And I didn't have really a safe place to process emotions at home. And so a lot of that got compiled and suppressed inside of me. And so in my case, the onset was about 12 years old that I started pulling my hair out. And it was extremely embarrassing. It felt like no matter what I did, I couldn't control it. I couldn't fix it. I was extremely self-conscious all the time and really embarrassed. And yet felt like I was powerless to control it, you know? And so that was something that really affected my confidence for many, many years. because I just, my parents wanted to help, but they didn't know how. And so some of the things that they did to try to help had a very negative effect on me as well and my self-esteem.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's so interesting to me to read about that and to read even, you mentioned at a different part of your book, your experience with self-harm and kind of just the way that it sounds like you were writing about those kind of giving you almost in a sense, like this safe place for a minute to like, just have this release, this like total relief almost. In a similar way with me, like I was telling you earlier, I experienced with my eating disorder. It's like, it's damaging to your body, like incredibly damaging, like, but it feels so helpful. And it's kind of like this thing you're grasping on to try to just survive. Because when you think about just stuffing down all your emotions and knowing that like the church saw mental health as demonic, and if you went to them, they would perform an exorcism on you. It's like, I know I felt so afraid of those things that I would do anything to ignore them, especially like growing up closeted. Like you, how old were you when you realized you were gay?
Oh gosh, I wasn't until I was like 23, 24 years old.
Okay. I got you.
Because I was so isolated, you know, and purity culture was such a huge part of my upbringing that I had no ability to even identify that until much later on in life.
Yeah, that makes sense. Do you feel like a big part of that? Because like when I think of like my eating disorder, I think of how separate I had to keep myself from my body in order to do that to myself. So it was kind of like I was using my body to make myself feel better by abusing my body. Do you how would you describe that and talk about that when it came to self-harm or trichotillomania?
I think self-harm and trichotillomania are different. Although I think some people see trick as a form of self-harm, I never really used it that way. For me, it was like a compulsive behavior I couldn't control. Although I think stress definitely made it worse and it definitely became like a stress reliever for me, I never saw it as a form of self-harm necessarily, although I think some people do.
Okay.
For me, self-harm definitely was a way of, you know, I think some people think, oh, it's a suicide attempt, but it's actually the opposite. For me, it was a form of survival, of trying to survive. And I think the way that you described it in terms of your eating disorder is very similar. It's your kind of disassociating and using your body as a way to survive horrible inner pain and trauma by harming your body. And it seems like a hard thing for people who have never experienced it to grasp. I tried hard when I wrote Refocusing My Family to give people a glimpse into what that was like. Without triggering people who had been there, you know?
Yeah.
But the reality of my life was that it was definitely something that was like a survival tactic that I turned to when I didn't know how else to survive or how else to make it through. Something about, and I think the lack of validation over my pain somehow tied into my self-harm, because for me, sometimes looking at those scars was a way of saying, see, I am in pain. This is validation of it. And so sometimes my scars would last for weeks or months. But looking at them like gave me like a sense of validation that my pain was real.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. Oh my goodness. Wow, yeah, the way you talk about it as like survival strategy, I love talking about stuff, these things in that way, because I mean, at least like from my experience, it feels like the ability to look at to look at that with compassion of like, why was I cutting myself? Or why was I using food to cope and stuff like that? It's like being able to see that as like, oh, that was you trying to survive. That was your brain becoming like creative and trying to find a way for you to get to the next moment because the environment you were in didn't foster that. I feel like that's such a better way, just a more, I guess, healthier way to just heal and to view yourself and to heal the relationship that you have with your body. Because like outwardly it looks like, oh, I'm hurting myself, but really you're trying to save yourself because you need anything to hold on to.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. That's, I think you wrote that really beautifully. I've never struggled with that myself, and the way you wrote it, I felt like I was like feeling the emotions and whatnot with you just from how you talked about it. How did that transition to, you said you you realized you were gay when you were 23?
Yeah, I was about 23 when I started figuring it out.
Okay, what did that look like?
Well,
that was complicated
as well. Yes. You know, I think, like I mentioned before, purity culture really masked my ability to identify my sexual orientation early on, because I was taught that you just, if you love God, you save yourself for marriage and you don't date a lot and you wait for your knight in shining. Basically, you know, if you do all the right things and you please God with your life, eventually this knight in shining armor is going to ride in on a white horse and sweep you off to happily ever after. And so that belief, you know, is something I embraced wholeheartedly because it was taught to me and it was expected of me, and because I genuinely wanted to please God with my life, right? I wanted to be a good example. I wanted to serve God. And so I never dated. I was very much just kind of focused and on track with what I was wanting to do, and just kind of fell into that lie. And so it wasn't until I was in my early 20s and fell in love with my female roommate. Oops.
Whoops.
That was like, that was my, I call it my epiphany of horror, because it was like, oh my gosh, I'm feeling things I've never felt before for anyone. But I'm definitely not supposed to feel it for you. Like, that much I knew, you know, like this is very, very wrong. These two worlds can never coincide. And so that created a very deep internal war. In fact, I had been free from self-harm for about 5 years. And when this happened, I relapsed because the internal war was so deep inside of me of, you cannot be both gay and Christian. And it caused me to spiral into a very dark place of self-hatred and self-harm and even suicidal ideations.
Yeah.
And I had nowhere to go, no one to talk to. And so it was a very long process. Really what happened is I got to the point where I was like, I'm either going to have to look this in the face and face my fear head on, or it's going to be the thing that kills me. And so it was, I really didn't have a lot of resources. I really had to work hard at finding resources. You know, therapy was very helpful for me at that point. Finding an affirming community was helpful. Working through theology was helpful. But it really had to break through the paradigm of what I had been taught versus what research is showing about the history and culture of how the Bible was written.
Yeah.
And so some of those things slowly started to set me free. But accepting myself took a long time and was a very complicated and dark process. And yet, when I finally figured it out, it felt like all these pieces that had been misaligned for so many years suddenly fell into place.
Ugh.
And I figured it out. And I felt like I was both terrified of what was to come, but I also felt like this peace that grounded me and this joy of knowing, like, this is who I was meant to be all along. And so coming out came at a great cost for me. You know, obviously, with a dad that works at Focus on the Family, you don't expect that to go well.
Yeah.
And it didn't. And so it was by far the hardest decision I've ever made. And also I would still say the best, because I feel like I came alive the day that I came out.
Wow.
And I would never change that for anything, even though it's come at a high cost. I've never felt more alive. I've never felt more free. I've never felt more at peace or at home in my own skin. It just finally felt right. And in a lot, honestly, a lot of the struggle, maybe not initially because of all the trauma that happened with my family when I came out, but over time, as I gained footing, things like self-harm just kind of naturally fell away because it was like I had finally found my place.
Yeah. It's like you finally got to be on your own side.
Yeah.
That's so special. There's really nothing comparable to the experience of coming out and getting to, after all those years of like shoving things down that you're afraid of in yourself and that you're told make you bad or dirty or wrong, even things like not being able to embrace depression or anxiety, things that like are so just demonized, being able to see these parts of who you are, being able to see your sexuality as not bad or broken, but absolutely beautiful and welcome and celebrated,
mm-hmm.
and getting to like embrace that without hiding is so spectacular. It's like, I love the way you talked about it. It's such a great freeing feeling where you do get to feel at home inside your own skin because you know that all of you is welcome. You're not trying to keep mm-hmm. these other parts away so you don't have to.
Or divide yourself.
Yeah, you don't have to divide yourself. What did it feel like to be at home in your own skin? Like, how did that feel?
It felt like coming home.
Mm-hmm.
Like finally finding your place in the world. I don't know how else to describe it other than saying, like, I feel like I came alive that day.
Yeah.
For the first time. Like, I had finally figured it out. I had finally found myself. And like I said, not to say that it was all peaches and roses, you know, like I went through a very dark time after coming out because my family, you know, basically they walked out when I told them initially. And then when we talked afterwards, they compared me to murderers and pedophiles and said, we feel like you've died. You're so selfish. How dare you do this to the family? And they took away my keys to the house. That was just like the beginning of you know, bad things to come. And we had about 2 years of very strained, awkward, difficult contact. And then after I got married to Clara, my wife, they cut ties completely. I had no family at my wedding.
Mm.
And then they cut ties completely and we haven't spoken since. So it's been a very tumultuous ride in that aspect with a lot of grief and sorrow. But I still contend that it was the best decision I could have ever made. And that it was finally a decision that I made for myself rather than for other people.
Yeah.
And that was long overdue.
Wow. Partially just because I want to know for personal reasons, because I feel like I'm in a similar, I guess when it comes to family, like navigating the relationships after coming out when there is that big, I want to say disagreement, but it's so much more than just a disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that big divide, like that's such, just because it's like everything you grew up believing, kind of how we were talking about at the beginning, like everything we believed made us a good woman or made us like godly or acceptable or whatnot. Like, I know I saw my parents as like everything they say is right and everything else is wrong, and how mm-hmm. we're talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
How did you kind of manage to come out on the other side of that? Like, what did that look like in the middle of learning that maybe that wasn't true and maybe you are okay with these different, I guess, I want to say views. It's just so much more than a disagreement. I don't even know what to call it. It's so much bigger than that.
And for me, I think it's been a process of slowly over time gaining footing gaining ground in confidence of who I am, of deconstructing bad theology, of surrounding myself with people who affirm my identity, creating, you know, I think for a lot of people, it's important to create boundaries around family that's not affirming and mm-hmm. limit your time with them. Because I think the more that you steep yourself in non-affirming theology, or that you allow yourself to be in those spaces where people are not affirming of who you are, the more that those negative tapes continue to play in your head and you continue to believe those lies about yourself. But once you've had some distance and some time and you've surrounded yourself with good, positive people, I think you become a lot stronger in who you are, and you have the strength to then set healthy boundaries that protect your mental health and well-being.
Yeah, that is very, very wise and so difficult to do. And it's so powerful to be able to do that for yourself and to be able to just advocate and know what you need and who you are and to know that that's okay. And
mm-hmm. yeah,
just kind of redefine.
Yeah. And in fact, the work that I do now primarily centers around supporting LGBTQ people who are trying to navigate their coming out process.
Okay. Tell me about that.
Well, when I wrote Refocusing My Family, I did it basically with the goal of giving people a voice, because we really didn't have LGBT memoirs from people of faith. And I felt like that was something that was needed, was a story that people could identify with and could find themselves. Because when I was going through that, I felt so alone. Like, I had no idea that other gay Christians even existed. You know, like, I thought, surely I am the only person who would ever dare show up gay in a conservative Christian family, you know? Mm-hmm. And so realizing that there's other people out there like you and giving voice to this narrative that really represents thousands and thousands of people, you know, was kind of my goal, because I wanted them to feel less isolated and alone in their journey. And yet when I published that, and I started touring and speaking, I very quickly realized, one, this is not just my story. Like, this is the story of thousands of people. People were writing me from all over the world that had gotten a hold of it and was like, oh my gosh, I feel like I'm reading my own life story on a book, you know?
Yeah.
And so that was encouraging, because I felt like it was hitting the right audience. But then I also started hearing just the same questions, like they were on repeat, over and over and over, of how do I know when I'm ready to come out? What if I'm in ministry? What if my parents are in ministry? What, you know, just the same things over and over and over. And I realized that there was we had a lot of great theology books coming out about how to deconstruct bad theology and what the Bible really says about same-sex relationships and all that. But there was nothing to, like, okay, I figured out that I'm gay, now what? You know, like, how do I navigate this? Especially from if you have a faith background. Uh-huh. And so I'd never planned on writing a second book as quickly as I did, but very quickly after Refocusing, I ended up writing Unashamed. And that ended up being the first coming out book for people of faith.
Oh, wow.
And I really took a holistic approach then to help them address things like internalized homophobia and transphobia, where that comes from, how that's rooted in us. How to redefine the way that we view God so that we can redefine the way that we view ourselves. How to know when you're ready to come out, the importance of affirming community, navigating boundaries, coping with grief and loss, all those kind of, you know, celebrating who you are. All those things were kind of this holistic approach that I took to Unashamed, and it's just a very practical guide. And I included a lot of the stories of people that I had met who then allowed me to share their story in the book. So it wasn't just my story I was sharing, but the story of a host of other people. And you know, it's providing support at the end of each chapter for friends and allies who are looking to support their loved ones so that they have practical tools of ways they can support their loved ones through their coming out process. And so that's kind of been a lot of where my work centers around, is helping those people and then educating people on the importance of full inclusion and the detriment that it has to families and to mental health when you don't. And you know, I think that's work that's probably going to need to happen for a long time still.
Yeah. Oh my goodness, that's incredible. I really want to go read your other book now. That's so special. I love that you're doing this work right now for other people who are experiencing that same thing, because I feel so privileged to, I guess, have the experience I do as I came out a couple of years ago, but to just know, to be welcomed into a community, mm-hmm. and to know the resources and be told the resources, and regardless of my family being accepting or not, like, it was clear to me that there were other people like me. And so, right. I just can't imagine feeling like the only one in the world, because it just wasn't talked about yet.
Right.
But to know, I bet it's so freeing now for you and so validating to just... to hear all the other stories and to hear people tell you that they feel like they're reading their story, reading your story, that must feel really special.
Yeah, it makes it feel worth it.
Yeah.
Because writing a memoir about, you know, all your life's biggest struggles and failures is not easy.
Yeah.
And there were certainly things that I put in the book that I didn't want to include in the book that were hard for me to share publicly. And yet I felt like if I'm going to do it, I have to be all in, because if it comes across in any way fake or unrelatable, it's not going to succeed. You know, like the only way people are going to relate to it is if it's vulnerable and raw and they can find themselves in the pages of the story. Yes. And so that really was my goal in writing Refocusing.
100%.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, there's so many things I want to ask you, but just for the sake of time, oh my goodness, there's seriously so many more things I want to ask you.
We'll have to do a part two.
Yes. Well, I want to read Unashamed, and we should talk about that, because I kind of want to read. Well,
absolutely,
I want to finish Refocusing
the
Family and then read Unashamed, because this is all just so good and so helpful and important. And I love the way you talk about it, because it just sounds, I can tell how much work you've done by how you talk about your younger self and your relationship with your family. And I know I was reading in the book that you still do some of the same traditions now. Like, I think it was like the pumpkin feast or something.
We do.
I think that's so sweet. Like, you found, like, you held on to things that were really special for you instead of just cutting it all out. Like, that's hard work to do, to keep the things you love instead
it
of
is.
Just throwing it all to the side. Because neither one is easy, but... and of course, you don't have to keep things you love if they're too harmful for you, but that wasn't just really hopeful for me to read while I kind of navigate what my family life, like, what my family life is going to look like post, I guess, growing up family. So that was really special.
And a lot of that comes in layers too, you know.
Yeah.
You sift it and you take it and you know, there's things that were still really meaningful for me in the beginning that aren't as meaningful now, and there's still other things that I really cling to, and there's things that I've, you know, from my childhood that I had boxes of stuff that I held on to, that when I got married I had to sit and go through all these things and figure out, like, do I want to keep this, do I not, and there was a lot of complicated emotions with some of those things that, you know, once held really good memories but now felt really tainted in a way, and so some of that's just come in layers and with time. And I think you get stronger with time, for sure.
Yeah.
If you set up healthy boundaries for yourself.
That's really special. Really, really special. Amber, I have one last question for you, and it's a bit of a change of pace. Is that cool?
Sure. Go for it.
Okay. Okay. Would you rather have a teeny tiny cheetah that lives in your pocket that is very sassy? This cheetah's like snarky. It kind of grows on you. Like, he makes fun of everything you would want to make fun of. And he just, like, he's kind of like that cool kid that's too cool for everybody, but is your friend. And he's just in your pocket, and only you know about him, and you can hear him talk to you, and he's just always there. Or would you rather have a personal assistant that was there for you, that could always bring you milkshakes? That's all that your personal assistant did, though, was all he could do is bring you milkshakes. And you can ask for this or that or whatnot, but he knows, he's always like, yeah, sure, I'll bring you that. But then he ends up bringing you a milkshake. Which one would you rather have?
This is such a random question.
I know.
Is it loaded?
No, I literally just thought of it as I was talking. That's typically what happens. It really is okay.
Well, I think I would go with the personal assistant, but I would go for coffee rather than milkshakes.
Okay.
And maybe tea. Something okay. comforting and warm.
I got you. So you ask like, hey, can you call the dentist and make an appointment? And they go, sure. But then they bring you a cup of coffee and think they did their job.
Oh, well, that'd be great if they did their job and brought the coffee both.
Oh, I got you. I got you. Okay. We'll make the adjustments. We'll train him up. We'll get
that'd
you a good
great.
Personal
yeah,
assistant. Oh, my goodness.
I would love to have one of those that did their job and brought me coffee both.
Okay. No cheetah in the pocket. We don't like that.
Well,
okay, I got you.
I think I've got my inner cheetah. Glennon Doyle's raising up the inner cheetah within me. So
yes.
I think I'm starting to harness some of that with Untamed.
Oh my gosh. I was literally, after we got off, I was going to ask if you had read Untamed and be like, let's just gush about Glennon.
It's like undoing me from like in all the best possible ways, you know, like.
So. Good.
I've not written in a book so much in forever. In fact, we're going to do it. I've launched a virtual book club this fall as a way of bringing people together during COVID. And it's specifically for like LGBT people and allies. And so we're reading different books each month by queer authors and allies. And I'm trying to, you know, bring in the authors to have conversations with us as often as possible. And
oh my gosh.
You know, I have low expectations of bringing in Glennon Doyle, but we are for sure reading Untamed next semester because it is transforming me more than I realized I needed. And I'm just like, I've written so much and I've cussed so much. I've got like all these cuss words all over in the book.
Like, I love it.
Ah, I can't believe like that is so good and it's so hard, but it's so good.
Yes.
Yeah, it's totally undoing me and I love it to death.
Oh my gosh, that is incredible. If you do get her to talk to your book club, please tell me because she is my ultimate hero in
I know,
everything
right?
in life. She's everything.
Yeah,
oh my
the jury's still out, but I don't want to have high expectations. We do have Nadia Boltz Weber joining us next semester though, so I'm
that's
really
awesome.
Excited about that.
So, so cool. Well, Amber, how can people find you on social media or your books? How do you want to tell people to get a hold of you?
Well, you can follow me on social media at Amber N, as in Nicole, Amber N Cantorna, across, you know, all platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. My website is ambercantorna.com. You can get information there. You can subscribe to my blog. You can get information about the book club where registration's closed right now for this season, but we'll launch registration in January for season 2. So I'm really excited about that for people that are wanting to plug into that community. We'd love to have you join.
Mm-hmm.
And information will be coming on that soon on the website. And then my books are, you know, available wherever books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the things. It's Refocusing My Family and Unashamed.
Okay. Amazing. Amazing. Well, I'm definitely going to be looking into all those things. Oh my goodness. Well, Amber, thank you so much again for being on my podcast. It was so much fun talking to you, asking you questions and gushing about Glennon Doyle as I love to do. It's a hobby of mine.
It was great chatting with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Have a great night.
You too. Bye-bye.